ID, the future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID, the future, we hear excerpts from the second part of an online Q&A that Discovery Institute's Daniel Reeves hosted with Dr. Stephen C. Meyer. Again, as in the first part, mostly on Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. This time, taking a look at some questions that skeptics have raised and also highlighting reasons for hope of intelligent design's increasing influence in mainstream science.
Kind of switching gears here a little bit, this is a God of the Gaps type question. So David Waters says, several months ago, I read The Last Superstition, A Refutation of the New Atheism by Edward Fazer, published in 2008, in which he appears to be dismissive of the ID arguments against Darwinism and atheism, as opposed to the classic arguments of Thomas Aquinas. And he says that ID is a God of the Gaps argument. How would you respond to that?
Well, chapter 20 in my book is solely devoted to refuting that claim. It's very odd. There's a false dichotomy even in the framing of Fazer's approach, because the one way to understand what I'm doing in the Return of the God Hypothesis is rehabilitating some of the famous Thomistic arguments among his five ways: the teleological argument from design, the cosmological argument. Aquinas makes a cosmological argument from contingency, which is almost identical to the fine-tuning argument in its logical form and structure. So I think that's a false dichotomy. It's not the classical arguments of Aquinas versus modern scientific arguments for the existence of God. The modern scientific arguments for the existence of God are ways of updating the Thomistic tradition with evidence that the great philosopher was not aware of and couldn't have been aware of in his time. So, but beyond that, a claim that something makes a God of the Gaps argument is a rhetorical shorthand for the claim that the argument commits the informal fallacy of an argument from ignorance. And those arguments have the following form. Cause A is not sufficient to produce effect X. Therefore, cause A cannot explain effect X. Therefore, cause B explains effect X. What's missing in an argument like that? We are ignorant of any positive evidence to know that cause B has the power to produce effect X. Okay? So that's an argument from ignorance. You're electing an alternative cause solely on the basis of the failure of some other cause to explain the effect in question, because that other cause lacks what's called causal adequacy. That's not the form of any of the intelligent design arguments. So this is a straw man critique, and we have repeated it many times. How do we argue? We're showing that cause A, in this case, let's call that naturalistic evolutionary processes, have been shown to be inadequate to produce the complex specified information required to produce new forms of life. And in both my two books, I give an exhaustive compendium of critical reasons for rejecting naturalistic evolutionary explanations for the origin of the first life and the origin of major new animal body plants. So that critique is amply supplied. But I don't then just say, well, therefore, intelligent design is the answer. I then show that intelligent design in our uniform and repeated experience has been repeatedly shown to be the only known cause capable of producing the cause X in complex specified information or functional information in a digital or alphabetic form. In other words, we have independent positive evidence from our knowledge of cause and effect that intelligent agents are capable of producing the effect in question. So we're supplying a premise that arguments from ignorance do not supply. We're supplying positive evidence for the explanatory power of an alternative explanatory hypothesis. Now, in the God hypothesis, I show that there are ways of doing that for abstract entities as well, and show that the God hypothesis, that once formulated, once we have a concept of God, there are certain causal powers associated with that concept that would, if true, or actual, provide a good explanation, a positive explanation for some of the features we see in the world around us, in particular, the fine-tuning and the beginning of a material universe out of no matter, no space, no time, no energy. In other words, the attributes of the required causal entity the entity required to explain the origin of the universe are attributes that have been long already assigned to the notion of God. You know, something that transcends space and time, that has great power, that is intelligent, that can create a change of state, etc. So I show that there are positive reasons to regard the God hypothesis as an adequate explanatory hypothesis. It's not just an argument from ignorance. And to underscore that just one other way, I repair to that quote from Richard Dawkins, where he says that the universe has exactly the properties we should expect to find if materialism were true. What I show is that, no, the universe has exactly the properties we should expect to find if theism were true. That theism as a concept has empirical content. There are things you would expect to see if a theistic God existed and had acted. And when we do see them, that provides a confirmation of the hypothesis. That's positive evidence. We're not arguing from ignorance. We're arguing from our knowledge of what we see in the world and from our understanding of what would follow theoretically from a certain type of explanatory concept. So that's done all the time in theoretical physics. And this is a perfectly legitimate, positive way to argue. And it's not a God of the gaps. It's a positive argument for the causal adequacy and explanatory power of first intelligent design and then a larger theistic design hypothesis. Anyway, I unpack this in a lot of detail in chapter 20. I also show that contrary to the common claim, it's a common story. Neil deGrasse Tyson told it in the Cosmos series. Newton did not make the God of the gaps arguments that are attributed to him. You know, he invoked God as an explanation for the beginning of the universe and for the design of the solar system. He made initial condition fine-tuning arguments, but he did not insert God into descriptions of the ongoing operation of physics. That would be an illicit use of the God hypothesis. When we're asking about what nature does ordinarily, we don't want to say God did it, because we want to know what causal powers natural entities have. And when we ask about those, then it is illicit to bring in a God explanation. And that would be a God of the gaps argument that I would say, no, that's a bad way to argue. But Newton didn't do that, and we're not doing that in making our case either for intelligent design or a theistic design hypothesis.
Now, Steve, you often talk about the idea of repeated and uniform experience. And one of the attendees today has a question about that. He says that, you know, from his repeated uniform experience, he's seeing something different. So Antoine Marco, I'm probably mispronouncing some of these names, so I apologize. But Antoine identifies as an atheist, and he says, I personally feel a few roadblocks with the God hypothesis. One of them is the idea of a disembodied mind, which goes against all of our observable repeated experience, as you would put it. When we talk about a mind, a brain is necessarily involved at the very least. So to me, when I hear an apologist like William Lane Craig speak about a disembodied mind, it sounds like a non-physical DVD player or a non-spatial mountain to his ears. In other words, an oxymoron. So he would like to just kind of hear your thoughts about that.
I've written an essay directly about that objection in the book Debating Darwin's Doubt. So I would recommend it to Antoine as something to chew on. Okay. Let me take a cut at it here in more limited time. Underlying the premise that the mind is always physical is a physicalist notion of the mind itself. And I think this requires getting into a little bit of the evidence from neuroscience, neurophysiology, and the arguments in the philosophy of mind about the nature of the human mind. I don't think the human mind is, it uses a brain, but I don't think what we mean by mind is identical with a brain. Our human minds do require brains. We use the brain as an instrument, but I think there's very strong evidence that the mind is using the brain as an instrument, that the mind is not the physical stuff, the synapses snapping away and the configurations. It's a necessary condition of the function of our minds in our state of being. I grant that. But what I'm inferring to is the higher cognitive capabilities, the mental capabilities that are responsible for the production of information. Those occur in a mental realm that has a brain as a substrate, but the mental realm, I think, is distinct from the brain. I'm a mind-body dualist, okay? And I think there are good independent arguments for that. And so having inferred a mind of some kind, I then ask a second order question. What is the most likely identity of the mind? What kind of a mind are we looking at? And by looking at the evidence from biology, but from also from the physics and the and cosmology, I think that the evidence of mind we have present in, for example, the fine tuning from the very beginning of the universe is not something that could be explained by any embodied mind within our cosmos. And therefore it requires a mind that transcends it. Now, maybe the mind of God is embodied. I mean, that's a possibility. In Judeo-Christian tradition, the teaching is that God is a spirit, that God is not an embodied mind, although God came in the Christian tradition in an embodied form. But I think mind is an entity that is separable in its function. There's a great quote from Henry Quastler, one of the original information scientists who applied information theory to molecular biology. And he said that the creation of new information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And I think that conscious activity occurs in a mental realm that has an independence from the purely physical. When I look out and see the color red, or I see Daniel's image on the screen right now, what I'm experiencing in my mental realm is distinct from the biological substrate that, yes, makes that possible in my current embodiment, but it's still a distinct type of experience from the electrical, chemical impulses that are snapping away in my synapses. That's a different type of phenomenon from my own first-person experience of consciousness. And yet it is conscious deliberation that produces information. So I'm inferring to a mind of that kind, leaving open the question of whether that's an embodied or disembodied mind. I think it's certainly a mind that transcends our physical universe because we see the indicators of mind from the very beginning. And being myself, having other reasons for holding to a Christian worldview, I take the scriptural teaching that God is a spirit as additional information informing me about what type of mind we might be dealing with from the creator of the universe. I don't think we can really settle the question, but I think it's perfectly logically consistent to think of the possibility of a mind that does not require the material substrate that makes our consciousness possible. So if that's helpful, there's a lot more to say about it, but I have written an essay on that in the Debating Darwin's Doubt. So it's a deep question in the philosophy of mind that's intersecting these questions of biological and cosmological origins. And I grant that it's a great question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Debating Darwin's Doubt is also another resource that will answer. So Vincent Moore from Huntsville, Alabama says, what kind of support have you received from high-level astrophysicists and cosmologists? So he's wondering, you know, why do you not have more support from recognized astrophysicists, cosmologists, theoretical physicists?
Well, I received a wonderful endorsement from Brian Keating, the astrophysicist who directs the BICEP 2 research program at the University of California, San Diego. Mm-hmm. So he's someone I specifically reached out to, and he wrote a glowing endorsement. I drew heavily in writing the book on the history of cosmology that was written by Jean-Pierre Lumine, great French astrophysicist, who has not endorsed the book, but is going to publish his book in English with the Discovery Institute. So we've had long conversations. I didn't ask, everyone that I knew for endorsements, but the work I'm doing is on the cosmology, and the story I tell about it is based on very standard developments in the field. And two of the great cosmologists and astrophysicists of the 20th century were people who deeply influenced my thinking on this. I met both of them at a conference in the early 80s, and one was Alan Sandage, others Robert Jastrow. Both of them are deceased, but they were at the initial conference that got me thinking about these questions. So I don't think in any way the story I tell is not at all outside the mainstream. It's very much mainstream science. The question is, what does it mean? And these are the what does it mean is the philosophical question that arises out of the discussion. So I have had endorsements of those of folks of that kind. I got a great endorsement from Robert Kaida, who is a plasma physicist. I got a couple endorsements from guys who are at the Alabama NASA Space Center in Huntsville, Bijan Namati, and one other gentleman. So if someone had a good objection to the argument I make, might be, you get the astrophysics wrong, or you get the cosmology wrong. I don't think we've done that. I think we've nailed it. So the facts of this are pretty well established, and I did my best to tell the history of the discoveries accurately, and then to reflect on them philosophically.
And as you and I were saying on the phone the other day, Steve, you know, it's only 4 weeks into the release since this book, and we've already seen a number of accolades and reviews positively for the book. So I expect that there will be more of these scientists who get to read the book in the coming weeks and share their thoughts on it as well. So we look forward to that.
Well, I have some scientists reading the book who are interested in endorsing it, but want to read the whole thing before they do so.
Yeah,
and so,
good.
You know, when you get to the end of a project, we were in December when we finally had everything edited, and then the Harper wanted endorsements back within 3 weeks. And I got some back very quickly, but others said, no, I only endorse books that I read entirely. And mm-hmm. so the endorsement from the Nobel laureate in physics, Brian Josephson, trickled in after we could put it on the dust jacket. But, you know, I've been actively involved in a number of scientific conferences for many, many years. So I have a lot of connections, a large network of people who are looking at things. And I know there's a shift in a theistic direction taking place within science. So it really hasn't been hard to find people, very highly qualified people who are willing to look at these arguments and who have explained that they themselves are sympathetic to them.
Here's another question that's, you know, kind of just big picture about the acceptance of these ideas. Jeff McClure says, have there been any recent and obvious breakthroughs into the neo-Darwinistic establishment regarding ID? In other words, are there any new signs that the naturalism machine, as he puts it, is showing weakness or decay?
Cracks all over the place, absolutely. I attended a conference in 2016 at the Royal Society. The conference was convened by leading evolutionary biologists who are completely dissatisfied with neo-Darwinism, who recognize that the mutation selection mechanism lacks the creative power necessary to account for the major innovations in the history of life. It does a great job of explaining small-scale variation and adaptation, but not large-scale innovation. And so these evolutionary biologists convened to discuss potential alternative models and evolutionary mechanisms. Alas, one of the science journalists who was a prime mover in advocating for this conference declared at the end that it was characterized by a lack of momentousness, that all these great scientists had convened, but they really didn't have solutions to the problems that they were addressing. And so many of you know that are supporters of Discovery, that we've been now for over 5 years supporting we've been providing external funding for research projects that are advancing the approach or concept of intelligent design as a guide to research in biology in particular, but some projects in cosmology at mainstream research universities. And it was at first surprising, but it is no longer surprising that there are many people in mainstream universities who are very supportive of intelligent design. Several of the endorsements I got for this book were from professors at high-powered research universities who hold titled and or endowed chairs. So I think there's a real shift going on. And, you know, after the trial in Dover in 2005, our intellectual opposite numbers in the staunch Darwinian camp loved to pronounce that intelligent design was, quote, over after Dover. I don't think anyone could really make that case now. There's just far from it. We have, you know, projects at major research universities around the world where scientists are not necessarily doing what Mike Behe and I and Bill Dembski and Jonathan Wells and others have done in making a positive case for intelligent design. Some of them are taking the concept of intelligent design and using it to guide future research. So we're in a stage of the research program that is typically thought to be bordering on maturity, you know, that the design concept is accepted widely enough by enough scientists in a network of researchers that they're no longer feel the need to prove it or to argue for it, but rather instead want to use it as a heuristic guide, a guide to further research.
And I think that's the motivation from a lot of ID theorists and scientists is not just, you know, the theory in and of itself, but the impact that will have on research. You know,
if you look at life as a design system, there are certain things you'd expect to find. And many of the researchers doing projects with our support are looking for features of systems like computer design patterns, like sophisticated modes of storing information or function in portions of the genome that were declared to be junk by the neo-Darwinians because they assumed that the evolutionary process produced all of the genome and therefore would have left a vast amount of flopsam and jepsam as a result of the unguided trial and error process. So there'd be a lot of junk mixed in, a lot of noise mixed in with a signal. We acknowledge that mutations are real processes, but we didn't expect that the genome would be so littered with mutational noise that you'd only have 2 or 3% of the genome that was functional. And so one of the predictions of ID was that the non-coding regions, the non-protein coding regions of the genome would turn out to be importantly functional. And that prediction is being borne out by things like the ENCODE project that are showing that the vast majority of the genome is in fact functional, and the non-coding regions are functioning something like an operating system in a computer that are controlling the timing and the expression of the coding files. So I think the design idea is proving fruitful in scientific research, not only as an explanation for facts we already have, but in guiding research projects to make discoveries that we hadn't made before.
But in addition, there's also, you know, all we've been talking about so far is DNA, RNA, protein, but there's, you know, other lines of evidence as well. So one question that I'm seeing now from Sean Madden, aside from the obvious information in DNA, RNA, protein, how do other molecular systems in biology demonstrate design? I'm thinking about carbohydrates, signaling molecules, asymmetric lipid bilayer. Is there something to those
stuff.
As well?
Well, wonderful new paper by Professor Tony Futterman, the Joseph R. Meyerson Professor of Biochemistry at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, with a postdoc that we have supported in his lab, Tamir. It's on the fine-tuning of the lipid bilayer. And they're bringing an ID approach to analyzing the specificity of this part of the cell, which was always thought to be the simple thing to explain in origin of life research. Just get a, you know, a little simple enclosure and trap some molecules on the inside, and over time metabolism will develop. Well, the simple enclosures are not simple. There's tens of thousands of different lipid species. They depend on very precise configurations of molecules. Only some of them have the functional specificity necessary for life. So there's specified complexity at other layers. In Darwin's Doubt, I looked at the sugar code that involves the use of carbohydrates as signaling molecules. That's very important information that's transmitted between cells. That's crucial to animal development. The pattern and distribution of membranes and membrane targets on the interior of cells is an important form of topological or geometric information that's critical to animal development. The characteristic of the tubulin structures, the cytoskeletal structures within the organisms, these are critical forms of what are called epigenetic or ontogenetic information beyond the genome, and many of them are not produced by the gene protein system alone. There's a direct transmission of that type of higher information from whole cell to whole cell. You know, in so there is a clear hierarchy of informational control on animal development that involves much more than just the DNA protein synthesis apparatus, as amazing and sophisticated in its design as it is.
So we are nearing the end of our time here. I noticed, by the way, looking through the list, that we have people from, I mean, West Coast to East Coast on today. We have people from Spain and Thailand and Serbia and the UK and all over the place.
Fantastic.
So it really is
wonderful.
Exciting to see that. And again, I want to just apologize that we couldn't get through more questions than we could in this amount of time. I just want to close out by, first of all, thanking Steve again for your time today. It's been really fun going through some of these questions. And thank you for, you know, pointing us back to some of your other resources as well, because I think that, you know, if people are interested in learning more, then they really should go back and read Debating Darwin's Doubt and, of course, finish reading Return of the God Hypothesis. So for those on today, thank you as well for supporting the launch of the book by pre-ordering and for being a part of the discussion today. There are a couple things that you can do to continue to help us to promote this book. And so I wanted to mention that before we close today. Of course, if you want to learn more about the book, returnofthegodhypothesis.com has a lot of great information and links there as well. And then obviously share with your friends, share on social media, mention it to your own local networks. And then most importantly, and this is a thing that Steve and I talked about beforehand that can really make an impact, is to review the book. And so once you've actually read the book, if you can go on to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, those are two of the top places where these reviews are seen. if you can go on there and leave an honest review, whatever that is extremely helpful. Steve was telling me that with every single one of his books that has come out, there have been people that review within the first few hours of release who haven't even read the book and will even admit that they haven't read the book, but they don't like it. And, you know, 1-star review, and they, you know, they'll just critique it right from the offset without actually considering the argument. So for those of you that have bought the book and do intend to read it, once you have, we strongly encourage you to go on there and leave a review. You don't have to spend half an hour on this. This can be a really quick thing that you just log on to Amazon.com. Just search for Return of the Jedi. Return of the God Hypothesis, and just leave a quick review on there. That's super helpful. We can't stress that enough. So thank you for attending today, for all your great questions. Steve, I'm going to ask one parting question, because this is really important for people who are looking for more information and also wanting to share it with their networks as well. Isaac asked this, and I think others are thinking it. Dr. Meyer, is there an online lecture, resource, or interview that you think would be a great first resource to share with skeptics?
Nate Jacobson, one of our Discovery staff guys, has built a beautiful website for the book and a beautiful new author page. And there are several interviews there that have already been posted under the media tab for the book. I did a long interview with Eric Metaxas 2 years ago that I think is, and I did a public talk on the Return of the God Hypothesis at our Science and Faith Conference in Dallas in 2019. I've also had a very good interview with Peter Robinson with the Uncommon Knowledge program that he puts out through Fox Nation and the Hoover Institution. So those are three things. Peter Robinson, the Eric Metaxas interview is the one I did at the Socrates in the City event. It was longer than his radio show, and I think it's under the heading of presentations. There's several tabs on the author page. So those are some things. I also did a long interview, a podcast interview with Brian Keating, the astrophysicist that I mentioned. So people that are interested in what a frontline astrophysicist had to say, both in praise of the book, but also challenging me on a number of points. And we had a very good discussion. So there's plenty of resources. You can kind of choose the ones that you think would be best for whomever you would like to share this content with.
That's great, Steve. Yeah. And returnofthegodhypothesis.com is constantly updated. So Steve has a number of other interviews and things lined up as well. So those will be added to the site.
One other thing I should mention is on the site, there is an article that I published with the Federalist the first weekend the book was out that I forgot the title. It was, it might've been Three Scientific Discoveries That Revealed the Mind Behind the Universe. It was something close to the subtitle of the book. And it's about 1,000 words summarizing the argument from the book, describing each of the three evidences briefly and why they point in a theistic friendly direction. So that's a shareable piece of content that people can read in 5 minutes. So that's good too.
Well, thank you, Steve, so much for your time today. This has been really fun.
Thank you for everyone that submitted questions. The questions were very good, some of them very challenging in just the right way, and deep questions. So thank you for sharing those.
All right. Thank you all.
That was Daniel Reeves, Director of Education and Outreach for Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, hosting Stephen C. Meyer in an online Q&A session on Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. Available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and wherever great books are sold. For ID of the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
Visit us at IDTheFuture.com and IntelligentDesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.